Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Susan Niemann, author of the new book, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. Susan Niemann is also the author of five other books, including Evil in Modern Thought, Moral Clarity, A Guide for Grown-Up Idealists, Why Grow Up? Great title. Subversive Thoughts for an Infantile Age, The Unity of Reason, Rereading Kant, and Slow Fire. Welcome, Susan. It's great having you on Bookshelf.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with your fascinating background. You have been called an American moral philosopher, cultural commentator, and essayist. How does your life, your history, lead you to your books, and especially to this topic of evil?
You know, one of the nicer things about getting older is that your life starts to have a shape that you didn't realize when you were younger.
Good point.
And I now realize that probably the most important motivating factor in my life was the fact that I was born in the South, in Atlanta, Georgia, and my mother was involved in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. We weren't real Southerners. My parents were Yankee Jews who had moved down to Atlanta just before I was born, and it was always clear to me that we weren't from there, and all I wanted to do when I was a kid growing up was to get out of the South and go to New York or Europe,
right.
About which I knew nothing. But looking back on it, growing up in a time when there was clear good, there was clear evil, and my mother, who was not an intellectual or a politician, she was a thoughtful housewife, was there as part of a group of people who were making real change, real progress for the better. I think that influenced me probably more than anything else, led me to study philosophy later after some interesting circuitous routes. And in 1982, I was writing a dissertation on Immanuel Kant, and it was easy to get a fellowship to spend a year in Berlin, which is what I thought it would be. It was a time at which very few Americans and even mm-hmm. fewer Jews set foot in Germany, so I was being asked all the time, what's a nice Jewish girl going to spend a year in the home of the enemy? And my answer at the time was, look, the war has been over for almost 40 years. Isn't it racist to blame the entire German people? At this point in time, I'm going to go and I'm going to think about Kant and Goethe and forget about the war. And I land in Berlin, and the war is very, very present.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. So that pivoted me into a direction of thinking about evil, thinking about, in particular, how nations come to terms with the evil in their past.
How was it present, the war, when you first went there?
So, first of all, it was physically present. You could still see bullet holes. There was the wall, of course, which is a result of the war. But most importantly, they were not the big monuments at the time, but young or youngish people in their 20s and 30s who were ashamed and horrified about the fact that their parents and teachers had been Nazis were pressing to do something. So that went on through art, film, theater. The longest running play in Berlin at the time was a little off, like an off-Broadway production called It Wasn't Me, Hitler Did It.
Wow.
And
what a great title.
Right. Which was in the West the general view
right.
of the people who were in power. And these people, civil society, usually fairly educated at that point, people who were pushing for examining Berlin's history, people would do explorations of their neighborhoods. So who were the Nazis? Was there anybody hiding Jews? What actually went on? And doing little exhibits. At that point, almost nothing was state-funded because the West German government wasn't interested in examining its past. The East German government was rather different because the leaders of the East German government had all spent the war in concentration camps or in exile in Moscow because the Nazis' first victims were not Jews. They were Germans who were communists and social democrats,
right,
political prisoners. So that was who was running the east side of the country. Now, the anti-fascism was certainly instrumentalized at various points by the East German government, but at least the basic message, Nazis were bad and defeating them was good, was something that you heard on the east side of the country. You didn't at the time hear it on the west side of the country.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
So listen to you talk, I get this sense that you've always been the other in a way. And yet that's been okay with you. It sounds like it's part of your identity now.
That's such a good question. The truth is, I once realized, and I was actually in California at a conference at Stanford, and I once realized, well, if I got to have two lives, it really would be quite nice to feel at home in the world and go to the weddings of the people your children went to kindergarten with. But if you only get to have one, I'm happy with the one that I've had. Yes, I have lived and worked in three countries. I think growing up as a liberal Yankee Jew in Atlanta of the late 50s and 60s probably predestined me
right.
to not feel at home in
right.
the world.
Right, it carved your shape.
Yeah.
So your new book, Learning from the Germans, it's described as a combination of philosophy, reflection, stories, and interviews with Americans and Germans who grapple with their history. Is there a story or interview or conversation reflection that stands out in your mind now?
There are so many, but I will take one. Let me say that in talking about my background, there's a way in which I've been writing this book all my life, but it's also true that this book began, the idea for the book happened at a particular moment. It was June 9, 2015, and I was standing in my apartment in Berlin watching President Obama give the eulogy for the 9 churchgoers who were massacred in Charleston, and I was crying. I was standing up at a standing desk and watching this. And at the same time, there was something hopeful about it because Nikki Haley, of all people, was taking down the Confederate flag and Walmart was saying, you know, they weren't going to sell Confederate memorabilia anymore. And I thought, gosh, America's finally ready to face up to its violent, murderous past. And I've been watching Germany do this for 30 years
right.
and more. The Germans have long compound words for everything, so they actually have a word for this. Actually, they have several words. Vergangenheitsaufarbeitung, which I translate as working off the past. So America is finally doing this. And at the same time, just a couple of months later, thousands of Germans welcomed 1 million refugees. And really welcomed them, not just, I mean, they stood on the train stations with signs saying welcome. They took people into their homes. They spent time and are still spending time teaching them German, helping them with the bureaucracy.
Now that's a nice story.
Playing soccer and music with the kids. Mm-hmm. And it is still the case that although we've had some backlash and we have a right-wing party that's now in parliament, unfortunately, an anti-immigrant party, it is still the case that more people are involved in active refugee integration than voted for the right-wing party. So I thought, gosh, this is, you can tell when people actually face up to their past, it affects the way they deal with political questions in the present. Mm-hmm. And I decided to write this book. And I, at the same time, I got a letter. I had written a small thing that got onto the internet from someone who described himself as a white conservative in Mississippi who was genuinely curious about what the South should do with its past, whether the streets should be renamed, mm-hmm. whether the statues should come down. This is 2015. And I got invited to give a talk in Oxford, Mississippi, at the University of Mississippi, I, who was nervous about crossing the Mississippi state line, was absolutely taken with the work of a small group called the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation. And I was so impressed by the work that they were doing, half black, half white, examining Southern history, that I asked them if I could come back for half a year and just watch and follow what they were doing and interviewing people. So there, I did a lot of really interesting interviews, both in the American South. I should say, I don't believe that racism is only a problem in the South. On the contrary. But I focus on the South in the book because the South is like a magnifying glass for the rest of the country. And because there's so many African Americans there, the question of race is always present. You can't avoid it in the way that you can in other parts of the country. White people can avoid it the way that you can in other parts of the country. And also because Mississippians, Southerners in particular, but especially Mississippians, are obsessed with their history. So you can't say, oh, it's the American spirit, forget about your past, and right, look towards the future. They're always talking about their history. They may get it wrong, and they build a lot of myths, but the history is there. So I spent half a year there, and probably the most impressive person I had the privilege of interviewing was Bryan Stevenson, who is one of my heroes. Bryan Stevenson is well known for two things. One is he wrote an incredible book called Just Mercy, which talks about mass incarceration and the death penalty. He spends a good part of his life fighting to keep people on death row from being executed. And it's a beautiful book. I highly recommend it. But the other thing that he's known for in this country is creating the National Lynching Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. And I read his book, and I read some interviews with him in which he said he was inspired by visiting Germany, that the National Lynching Museum was inspired by visiting Germany, seeing the way that the iconography of many places in Germany, particularly Berlin, has been transformed by monuments. Many people have seen a picture of the Holocaust Memorial, but there are 473 monuments to the victims of Nazism.
I had no idea. 473.
Just in Berlin.
You're kidding.
Just in Berlin. No, no, no. You know, Germans being thorough, they, there are books about,
right,
you know, that have tallied them. So Bryan Stevenson was somebody I very much wanted to interview. He's an African-American who said the Germans have genuinely felt shame, and we need to feel shame in this country. We need to transform our iconography to remember the victims. We also need to remember the heroes. It was quite an interesting moment when he said, there were white Southerners who were opposed to slavery and lynching, and you don't know their names.
Right.
We need to remember their names so that we can have the fabric of our country can be expanded and rewritten in certain ways to include also our shameful past, also the people who resisted, and have that affect our contemporary politics the way the Germans have had that. He was very impressed that people said to him, death penalty? We can't have a death penalty here. That's what the Nazis did.
I'm hearing a couple of different central points. And one is that no matter how dark something is, an event, there is always someone who's trying to do good within that. And the other one is that if we don't deal with our past, it comes back, or it just doesn't go away. And so I'm wondering about now here in the United States, do you think that some of the things that are happening here are because perhaps we haven't fully dealt with the past?
I think there is no question that the current occupant of the White House was elected in part because millions of Americans were threatened by the fact that not only had there been a black family in the White House for 8 years, it's that
every member of that family, including the first granny, Marian Robinson, behaved with more grace and dignity and integrity than we have seen, certainly in my lifetime. And in a way, the Obama family, I disagree with some of his policies, but sure, that doesn't matter. In a way, they undercut basically every excuse for racism. One of my daughters said, she was just, I think, about 20 at the time. She said, I can't imagine anything worse than being a teenager in the White House, but being the first African-American teenagers in the White House. And they did it perfectly.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that enraged, I mean, I know because it was said, it enraged millions of Americans who feel threatened by the fact that the demography is changing and that the Obamas deprived us of any genuine excuses for racism. The silver lining that I am discovering is that for the rest of us who supported President Obama and are horrified by the racism that we're seeing now in this administration, I think white people have become aware that white supremacy has a deeper and longer history than we were able to acknowledge. If you think about it, white supremacy wasn't even a word that got used in the mainstream media until about a year and a half ago.
That's a good point.
You know? And, I mean, that was a radical left term, and now you see it in the New York Times and the Washington Post and so on. You know, we always knew, yes, there was slavery, but then we fought a civil war. Yes, there was segregation, but then we had the civil rights movement. And I think the backlash to the Obamas that produced the Trump family has made us aware of, no, we actually need to examine how deep these problems go. And you see it in the discussions over the Confederate memorials. People are much more aware of what happened during Reconstruction, of when the memorials were created and why. You just see a level of discussion that shows that white Americans are coming, or many of us,
especially, I think, the younger people,
absolutely, are closer to where black Americans have been for a long time.
So if you were to recommend a way for us to deal with our past, I understand that, you know, you talk about reparations towards blacks in the United States. Do you think that that would also affect how immigrants are treated? Do you think that that would reverberate through other groups?
So the reparations question is a complicated one. I don't know how much time you want to spend on that. I was not sure what I felt about reparations. I've seen various sides of the debate, and African Americans who were against reparations because they feel that the real issue is social democracy and that America should be a social democracy. Well, I have the good fortune to live in a social democracy, even under a conservative government. Bernie Sanders, you know, proposals are to the right of Angela Merkel's.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because certain things like healthcare and education and a month-long paid vacation and over a year parental leave and all of those kinds of things are taken to be rights and not benefits. And that's pretty much true all over Europe. So I would be in favor of all of those things for the United States, of course. But I began thought experiment to think, well, Holocaust survivors who stayed in Germany after the war, and some did, would get the same level of social rights as everybody else did. Wouldn't we think they were owed something more? Now, I know the question is always, yes, but slavery was generations ago. The truth is, if you dig into the history, we had forms of neo-slavery that lasted all the way up to the Second World War, and we have had victims of racist government policies up through, officially, the late 60s. Unofficially, much longer, mm-hmm. of course. So I think Africans and Americans are a different case from the immigrants because, of course, they were captured and enslaved and brought to this country against their wills, although most of them have wanted to stay and become genuine Americans. They have fought to become considered full-fledged citizens of America. Immigration is a different story, but what I think we certainly need to do is, and I think the more we face racism, of course, the better off every minority group will be in this country, although it's going to be the case that white people will soon be in the minority. But to recognize the contributions of immigrants, the way this is an immigrant country, there's an absolutely marvelous Bruce Springsteen song, which I love, American Land. The hands who built the country, we're still trying to keep out, you know.
Right.
And when somebody in the Trump administration wanted to rewrite Emma Lazarus's poem on the Statue of Liberty, give me, you're tired, you're poor, you're hungry, you're poor huddled masses yearning to breathe free. That's America. That's the idea of America.
It's the ideal.
It is the ideal of America. And to keep lifting that up and keep remembering that we would not be, I mean, we're very far from realizing all the ideals that we proclaim, but we wouldn't be even close without immigrants. By the way, this was an interesting statistic that I found out. Most white people in this country are descended from people who immigrated after the Civil War, in the beginning of the 20th century.
That's interesting.
Isn't that? Yeah, I was surprised by that, to find that out too. But
we're such a divided country, though, now. It feels that way, at least. As a citizen, it feels like we are, I think, the most divided we've been in a long time. So how do you see us moving towards some of these lessons that you say Germany has learned?
I think we already are. I think the very fact that we're seeing things like, I mean, when I wrote the chapter on reparations, I knew if I was talking about parallels between the German experience and the American experience. And of course, they're different. I spend the first chapter of the book pointing out the differences. It's not that I think we can one-to-one apply the lessons that Germany had to this country. But I knew I was going to have to write about reparations. And when I finished thinking through that chapter, you're a writer. You often write to figure out exactly what you think.
To figure out what you're writing.
Yeah, well, just to figure out, okay, do I believe this or that? Uh-huh. I thought, oh boy, am I going out on a limb. And people who have agreed with me so far are going to get to the end of the book and say, no, now she's gone too far. I did not imagine that you would have presidential candidates 6 months later talking about this question or hearings in the House. So I think we're moving things like the 1619 Project that the New York Times did, which is not just to commemorate the 400th anniversary of slavery, but to say, wait a second, we actually need to look at slavery and its consequences as fundamental to American history. It's not just a little blip.
Right.
It has affected our entire history. And if you've studied the history of post-war Germany, you realize, of course, Newt Gingrich is going to push back and say, no, you're tearing the fabric of our nation and we need to be proud of our country and so on. This is what the Nazis said for a good 50 years after the war. That is, even the former Nazis would talk about, the Wehrmacht, there were atrocities, but they were committed by a few bad apples. The Wehrmacht was just defending their homeland, and our grandparents were heroes. I have pictures that show that. You know, people do not want to face shameful parts of their history. Of course they don't. Of course we'd rather look at the parts of our history that we're proud of.
I think a lot of people feel like it wasn't me. I didn't do it.
This is correct. But once you start reading about the ways in which America's wealth has been built on slavery, and that's not simply from cotton industry, although cotton was the oil of the 19th century,
And there's a wonderful book called The Half Has Never Been Told. Highly recommend it because it shows how, in very surprising ways, how much of the American economy was built on that. But up to things like, in order to get the New Deal through Congress with Southern racist senators and representatives, FDR had to exclude domestic workers and farm workers from getting Social Security or housing loans. What percentage of African American jobs were in farms or Social Security? Something like 70%. So what that meant is that it was that as white Americans were moving into the middle class and able to own their own homes and retire with some slight measure of Social Security, black Americans did not have the tools to get into the middle class. And that was not a question of individual prejudice. That was a question of law.
Yeah. Institutional prejudice.
Well, institutional law.
Right.
And, you know, when you realize if you're fortunate enough to inherit anything when your parents pass, you got to pay off their debts before you get to enjoy the inheritance. And there's justice in that. You can't simply say, oh, yeah, I'll take the house, but I don't want to pay off
I don't want the bills.
Life doesn't work that way. My view is that a grown-up relationship to our country is like a grown-up relationship to our parents. You know, when we're children, we basically accept everything they have to say. And when we're adolescents, maybe we reject everything
right.
they have to say. And when we're adults, we kind of sift through it and say, okay, I'm glad and proud that my mother gave me this set of values or this kind of way of looking at the world. And, you know, this is the stuff I'd rather not pass on to my children.
We find our identity.
Exactly. And we find it also by dealing with the parts mm-hmm. of our identity that we inherited
right.
and couldn't do anything
right.
about. So I think we need to do exactly the same thing with our country.
In the book, you say that the criminalization of African Americans was deliberate and intentional. So apart from this example of FDR and financial, you know, security, Social Security, can you give us another?
I can indeed. And this is another book recommendation. It's called Slavery by Another Name. Won a Pulitzer. Highly recommended. A shocking book. So the 13th Amendment says you cannot take away another person's freedom unless they've committed a crime.
Correct.
So what do they do after Reconstruction in the South? They instituted so-called black codes, a set of laws for African Americans in which they virtually criminalized behavior from not being employed by a white person to talking loudly in the presence of a white woman to selling vegetables after sundown. I mean, criminalized almost everything. They then had excuses to lock up a vast number of African Americans and to rent them at extremely low wages to mining companies, plantations, certain factories making bricks. And often the people profiting from that labor were the same people in the sheriff's office or their brother-in-law or something. This was in many ways worse than chattel slavery because a slave owner who pays $1,000 for a human being has at least an instrumental interest in protecting his investment and making sure that there's sort of minimum standards of nutrition and health that
are
met.
It's also more obvious. It's not as
correct.
invisible.
Correct. But knowing that they had an unlimited supply of slave labor, many of these companies worked people to death. The mortality rate in some of them was 40%. And this went on again all the way, some instance of it, into the Second World War. It was called convict leasing.
And it's quite horrible to know the reason why FDR got onto the case of the last cases of convictless leasing. It's because somebody pointed out that the Japanese, they were in the middle of war, and the Japanese were pointing out that Americans didn't treat people of color all that well, so maybe the people of color shouldn't support America during the war. And FDR called the FBI and said, get on it, no more convict leasing.
Oh, okay.
So there's my favorite or least favorite example.
Yeah, least favorite.
Yeah.
Okay, right now, you still live in Berlin.
I do.
And you're still a Jewish woman.
I am.
So, and you're still from the South originally.
I am.
So what is that like for you now with all this knowledge and history in your head and what you work on and what you live? What is it like?
So it's interesting. In 1988, I had lived in Berlin for 6 years, and I decided to leave for two reasons. One was a terrible historical sense of smell or prescience or whatever. Everybody was saying, nothing is ever going to happen here again. This is a dead town. In 1988, nobody saw reunification or any of this coming. But the second is I had a three-year-old son, and it seemed very clear to me that I couldn't raise children to be normal. I couldn't raise Jewish children. I couldn't even raise non-Aryan children to be normal. A lot of my friends were originally Chilean or Greek or something, and it was a very different place than it was when I was offered a job 12 years later in 2000 as the director of the Einstein Forum, which is a public, interdisciplinary, international think tank. And I was not clear. I had acquired two more children, my twin daughters. I was not certain what it would be like for them to move there, and I made several trips and decided the New Berlin is really, it's really much more international. It's much more comfortable. Story I tell in the book is that a couple of years ago, I was planning a Seder, and I went to buy matzah meal. It used to be the case that there was one store in all Berlin, and it was kind of hidden. That was when I lived in the 80s. Now I know that there are several. So I go to the store a couple of days before Pesach, and the store owner says there's no matzah meal in all Berlin. We underestimated. The demand is over the top. There's 30,000 Israelis living here. And as I was thinking, you know, am I going to grind it piece by piece to make the matzah balls? I realized that an Israeli friend of mine's parents were coming from Jerusalem to celebrate Passover with their son and daughter-in-law and grandson. And I could ask them if they'd bring an extra box.
You know? Bring one from Israel.
Yeah, bring one from Israel. So I feel quite comfortable. There is anti-Semitism. There is racism. I don't want to say that it's disappeared. It gets into the international press far more often than the pushback gets into the international press. I always meet people who've heard about one story or another. There was an Israeli Arab who was videotaped wearing a kippah and being attacked in Berlin maybe three quarters of a year ago. And I immediately got an email from an old friend in LA saying, are you and your children safe? And I said, you know, I hate to say it, but where were Jews killed this year? What country was that?
Right.
And what didn't get play was that after this incident happened, 2,500 Berliners, including our foreign minister, showed up for a demonstration the next day wearing kippot.
Wow.
And the tabloid, the city tabloid, which is in no sense, it's sort of center-right magazine, the daily, I don't know what the California equivalent would be. Its headline that day was Berlin Wears a Kippah, and they had a little paper kippot that you could cut out of the newspaper. I don't know if anybody wore them, but that is the pushback that people get and don't hear about very often here. So Berlin right now is a very multicultural city. My son and I, when the refugees had just arrived, he's an artist. He had an artist's residency in Marseille, where he said he didn't feel like going swimming because the Mediterranean had become a graveyard. So when he came home for a visit and I said, well, you know, let's do something fun. You want to go to an exhibit or something? He's an artist. He said, can we do something for the refugees? So I said, sure, of course. So we went and bought as much food as we could carry. We had trouble giving it away. There were so many people who were volunteering to do something for the refugees. We had to go around to different places. They said, well, we don't actually need any more. Try this place. So that's the kind of place that I live in now.
And now that you're on a book tour and you're going to all these different cities, does it feel different? I mean, does it feel like... this is also, does it depend on the part of the country you're in? Does it depend on whether it's the city or the country in terms of how much we have evolved or devolved?
So I am on the first half of my book tour, which has taken me to places like New York, D.C., L.A., San Francisco. I'm about to head for the Deep South.
Okay.
And that will be interesting. Again, I am pleased and a little surprised at the openness and the interest in the claims that I have been making, which I think are part of this Americans facing how racist parts of this country are under the surface. But on the other hand, I met in Baltimore, a close friend of my brother's had just gotten back from Tijuana. There are organizations, in particular Jewish organizations, but also other religious groups who are volunteering to go down to the border to help give legal advice and take care of people applying for asylum. And she was very shaken by it. She was in tears about some of the horrible stories that she had heard. And I mentioned this in one talk that I was giving, and three or four people in L.A. said, oh, yeah, we've been down to the border, and my synagogue is doing this. And
so look at the heroes.
Yeah, exactly. A friend of mine wearing a button from Hias, my people were refugees, too. Mm. So I do think that there are important things happening on the ground all over the country. Even in the Deep South, I know this because I'm in touch with the social justice activists that I know there.
I have one last question for you. What are you working on next?
A novel.
A novel, dear to my heart.
A novel that is mostly set in Berlin, so will cover some of the same basic issues, but from a quite different perspective, because, of course, a novel allows you more nuance,
yes,
different voices, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
Oh, well, we look forward to seeing it. Our time is up, Susan, but thank you so much for joining us. For more information on Susan Neiman and her books, please visit her website at http://Susan-Neiman, that's NEIMAN.DE/. It's different than what we usually read.
It's a German website.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.